Is it time for a podcast already?
Check 1-2, check 1-2, check 1-2, check 1-2.
I didn't know that.
Hello, listeners. Welcome back to another episode of the Garlic Jar Podcast Show. Tonight, we are picking right back up where we left off last week with Maddie and Sean. Say hey, guys.
Hey, everybody. What's going on?
Not much. Are we ready for the continuation of the mob?
I am. Yeah, you know what's really weird? It feels like we were just here yesterday doing this.
No, it definitely does. But, like, you know, it's always a pleasure to have Sean back. So whenever he's available, we like to get him on.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, of course.
It's great to be here.
So you said you got some good stuff cooked up for us tonight.
I do. We're gonna talk about some wars, and I got some information that hit the papers today locally that's ties Whitey Bulger to our area. So I want to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, that'd be pretty awesome. Now, Sean, you said that was today's papers, correct?
I believe it was. My brother texted me this afternoon and mentioned it to me. So I just glanced at the article, but I was aware of it. I should have mentioned something about it in the last episode, and I forgot, but I wasn't aware of well, I'll go into detail.
Yeah, no, because I'd like to, like, when we get to that point, I'd like to try and get that pulled up maybe on my online subscription, because I don't get the paper home anymore now. I get it electronically.
Same. We don't do the physical paper anymore either.
I was going to say, I like the electronic. Yeah. Yep. Agree. 100%, Jen.
So, all right, Sean, whenever you're ready there, friend, you just take it away.
Okay.
So what do we got?
Well, before we get into that, I just want to, I've been getting a lot of questions and comments and stuff, and I don't want to get into all of them now. We don't have time, but I do want to mention one thing. My buddy Billy Raids, he wanted me to say that a little bit more emphasis on the fact that he says he wanted me to emphasize that, you know, this isn't about a brotherhood. Like, when we're talking organized crime and stuff, it's all about every decision, everything they do is generated on making money. I mean, everything these guys do, no crime is too small, no crime is too big. And I thought I emphasized that. I thought I made it pretty clear, but I guess he just wanted to make that point that, you know, everything with these guys is making money. It's not about, you know, most of the time when a guy gets killed, it's over simple greed, you know?
I feel like that's one thing that the movies do.
Well, sure. In Hollywood, and that's a good point, Jen, because in Hollywood, it always seems like when a guy's getting killed, it's always that he breaks the code and he's betraying his brothers and, you know, this and that. And the thing is, the reality is that usually it's just a lot of times that somebody wants to just take his action over.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's what happens. And the other thing I want to emphasize is that, you know, when we're focusing on the Irish gangster, the Italian gangster, the Jewish gangster, I just want to make clear that you got to separate that from the Irish immigrant who came over and worked in the mines, or the Italian immigrant who came over and worked in the railroad, or the Jewish immigrant who escaped Nazi Germany and came over. You know what I mean? Like that. There's no connection other than just the ethnic bloodlines to those guys. A gangster's a gangster.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, and you can't use that term, well, you know, they're bad guys, but there are bad guys. They're still gangsters. You know, if it comes down to, you know, you living and them making money, they're going to make money every time.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of interesting that you mentioned that, though, Sean, because, you know, like, I kind of get that. I get that vibe a lot because, and I wanted to tell you this too, going into our episode, because, oh man, I was on the wire with Jenna earlier, you know, like, obviously earlier in the weekend, and I'm like, Jenna, I'm like, I was watching this documentary on Netflix.
Oh, yeah, you did.
And I hope I didn't piss her off. That's all I'm thinking in the back of my mind. I'm like, oh my God, it's like 2:30 in the morning, but I just got done watching Fear City, New York, and it's about the five families and the commission. And the five families, obviously, you know the names and everything like that. But I'm going to tell you, like, how you just talked about that, you know, it didn't seem like there was bloodthirst for money. This was bloodthirst for power. They, you know, they were more, I feel like, anything in that category of like a gangster, I think you were more territorial and you wanted to show power rather than make the diamond dollar at the end of the day, you know?
Well, I think it's a combination of both, the power and the money. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? They want to control industries, you know, like the unions, the healthcare, and concrete industry, everything. There's nothing, the garment industry, there's nothing, you know.
That surprised me, too, because what these five families in these mafia groups, I mean, my God, they had so much. They had their hands in everything. Everything that you could possibly think of. Automobiles, really vehicles, like you said, the healthcare industry, the garments, everything. And it was just crazy, Okay, but yeah, I'll let you go there. I had to share that detail with you. If you didn't see it, watch it. It's really good.
Okay, so the information that came out today, my brother texted me, says that, you know, there's an article, the Scranton Times, and it says that, you know, remember when I mentioned last time when we talked about the Winter Hill Gang, the Boston Irish Mob, that they were fixing horse races up and down the East Coast? Well, one of the racetracks that they were fixing the horses at was the Pocono Downs.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. And I knew that. I should have mentioned that. But the thing I didn't know is that, because remember I said that that's where Conley, the FBI guy, goes to Jeremiah O'Sullivan, the attorney, and tells him to leave Bulger and Fleming's name off the indictments. And that's how they took over Winter Hill. What I didn't know, according to this article, is that it continued after Bulger became boss, that they were still doing that. They were doping horses. They were fixing races. There were all kinds of shenanigans were going on. And the FBI knew it, of course, and they let it continue. And there's a lot of files that's been released. They're heavily redacted, but it's very clear that this continued. And the interesting thing is I wonder the role of Russell Bufalino in that, because originally when the Winter Hill Gang first started fixing the horses and they went to Pocono Downs, Howie Winter was the boss of Winter Hill, and he did reach out to Russell Bufalino, because we talked about the cooperation all the families have, and when they go into another territory, they always go to whoever's running that territory to tell them, kind of like Jimmy Burke did up in Boston with the BC basketball scandal. So I knew that Howie Winter did go to Bufalino, but what I wonder is, when Whitey started doing it when he was boss, did he go to Bufalino, or did he just do what Whitey does, you know, do whatever he wanted? And it goes to show you the reach that, remember, right, the cop that describes Whitey Bulger as an octopus, where the head is in South Boston, but the tentacles are reaching everywhere. And they reached all the way to our area here.
That's incredible.
So it's just interesting. I would say my guess would be he probably did reach out to Bufalino because of Bulger's relationship with old man Patriarca up in Rhode Island. And Patriarca was really close to Bufalino. So that would be my case. But I would just like to look a little more into this as the story starts to break. And I'll keep you guys posted as more information comes out about it. But it's pretty interesting tying him to our area.
That is interesting. Because I would never expect that name, you know?
Well, his reach was pretty far. I mean, you know, he went all the way to Oklahoma to do that one hit. I mean, he's, you know. But let's finish. Any questions before we move on?
No, I think I'm good.
Matt? I think we're good. No, I think we're good right now.
So when we last left, we were talking about Bulger's on the lam. So the prosecutor, Freddie Wycheck, comes in and he indicts Bulger. He gets tipped by the FBI and he goes on the lam. And there's some interesting stories that happened when Bulger was on the lam. And I'm just going to tell a couple of them, because who knows if they're legend or if they're really true stories. But so now this is 2006, I want to say. And Bulger's on the lam now for like 10 years. And he's the number two most wanted FBI on the FBI's most wanted list, right behind Osama bin Laden. And everybody in the country is looking for him. All law enforcement is looking for him. And the movie The Departed comes out. So
I know that one.
There's this. What's that?
I know that one.
That's a
good one. And that's loosely based on Whitey Bulger. The Nicholson character, the Jack Nicholson character, is loosely based on Whitey Bulger. So anyway, there's this cop in San Diego, and he's in the movies with his wife, and they're watching a movie. And he keeps looking back at this guy in the back role at the theater, and he keeps looking and looking, and his wife's like, you know, what's the matter, why do you keep staring at this guy? And he's like, nothing, don't worry about it. And then he keeps doing it and doing it. Finally his wife said, what the hell is the matter? And the cop's like, I don't know, but I think that guy in the back row, I think it's Whitey Bulger. And his wife's like, who the hell is Whitey Bulger? And he's like, the guy that this movie's based on. He says, you know, they plastered his picture all over a wall at the police precinct, you know, because he's the number two most wanted on the FBI's list. So he kept looking back. He's looking back. And then finally, you know, this is 2006, so not everybody had a cell phone then. So he goes looking for a phone. And when he came back, the guy was gone. So was that really Whitey Bulger watching his movie The Departed? I mean, who knows? You know what I mean? And the thing is, remember, when Bulger was eventually captured, he was captured in Malibu. So how far is Malibu from San Diego?
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, it could have been.
It could have been. And you know, this, according to this cop, I mean, he really thought it was him. You know, and the guy didn't do anything suspicious, you know, other than he just looked like him, you know. So he was keeping to himself there just watching the movie, but who knows?
It seems like he had some instinct there, though. I mean, to keep on looking back and having that feeling like, I know that guy, you know.
Well, you think about it. If you're a cop and, you're looking at that picture all day up on a wall, most wanted, and then you see a guy that looks like him, I mean... You know, but the funny thing is that when he did come back for making that call, the guy was gone.
Yeah.
So was that a coincidence? You know what I mean? Like, why'd the guy take off, you know?
Interesting.
So then the other story is, when Bulger finally gets captured, I forget when that was, 2012?
I think he was 2011,
2011.
Right?
Yeah, 2011. So he got captured. I remember that day. I don't know if you guys ever watched the ESPN, but they have that show Around the Horn.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that day they had all sportscasters from Boston on, and they were all telling different stories about how – because everybody up in Boston has a Whitey Bulger story. It's just everybody. You go in a bar, somebody tell you a story about it. Everybody's got a story. So everybody was going around telling their stories. And the one lady, she's what's her name? Jackie McMullen, I think's her name. She's the beat writer for the Boston Celtics for ESPN.
Oh, yeah, Jackie McMullen.
Okay, mm-hmm. So she tells this story that the famous sports personality up there, McDonough, forget his first name, his son is Sean McDonough. He does the college football for ESPN. But when he passed away, I want to say. 2007, 2008, it was like a celebrity funeral because he had ties, like all the big shots at NBC, every sportscaster in the country would come around, like the different personalities, different athletes, they all knew him. And the one thing is McDonough was really good friends with Whitey Bulger and Senator Bulger, the state Senate president, Whitey's brother. So Jackie McMullen's sitting in the church, they're getting ready for the funeral. And in walks Senator Bulger, and he there's nowhere to sit. There's one open seat in the pew right next to Jackie McMullen. So Senator Bulger sits right by her. And first time they ever met, they're talking to each other, and then they're getting ready to start the proceedings. And all of a sudden, Senator Bulger starts getting peaked. He's looking like he's going to pass out, and all of a sudden he passes out right there. So they call 911. Ambulance crew comes in. And are taking a look at him, everything. Anyway, they revive him, and he's okay. And he says, you know, sorry for disturbing everything. Get on with everything. You know, everything's fine. Well, as soon as the ambulance crew leaves, whispers start going through the church that one of the ambulance crew was Whitey Bulger in disguise.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And they asked Jackie McMullen. They says, you know, did you think it was Whitey Bulger? And she's like... Well, I don't know, but the guy, you know, it was like a rainy day. The guy had sunglasses on. He was kind of staying in the back. He really didn't do anything except just stand there. So he kind of looked a little suspicious, but she says, I don't know if it was really him, but it really doesn't matter. The Boston legend was cemented, you know, that the state senator faked having a heart attack so they could sneak his brother, his fugitive gangster brother, in to pay respects to McDonough. You know, and just final respects. And that's, is was that really Whitey Bulger? Who knows?
Huh.
Who knows? You know? But just an interesting story.
Yeah, for sure. That's a good one.
And then the last thing is we finish up on Bulger. So everybody knows what happened to him When was that? Was that last year when he got killed in prison?
Yeah, I think was it 2018? I think.
Was it 2018? Yeah. Okay.
I remember a headline. It was close to Halloween, actually, I think.
Okay. Yeah. Well, there's one conspiracy theory out there that I want to throw at you guys, and who knows if it's true or not, but, you know, the theory is that, you know, because something really always bothered me. As soon as I heard that they were transferring him, it bothered me because they said that he was a threat. Now, how could he be a threat? He's 90 years old. He can't even clench a fist. He was, like, confined to a wheelchair. He was on, you know, his deathbed anyway. So who was he a threat to? And then they transfer him to a prison where his enemies are. So why in the world would they do that? Why would the feds do that? It never made any sense to me. But the conspiracy theory is that the feds would protect Whitey for one last time. And they would. The one thing that this whole thing that hurt Whitey's reputation was that, you know, that he wasn't a foreman, because that's the worst thing you could be in South Boston. And the other thing is that he was involved in killing of women. And that's another no-no. So his reputation did take a hit. So the conspiracy theory is that the FBI faced his transfer, and they walked him out the back door. And then who knows? He's up in Cape Cod there, living out his last days. And then you get these gangsters who supposedly, you know, it takes four young guys in their prime to beat an old man to death, and they you know, his face is unrecognizable. They pull his tongue out and all this other stuff. And yeah, it was like ridiculous, like how they beat him. Like, but again, the legend is cemented. Like, now you have, you know, live by the sword, die by the sword. You know what I mean? Now the legend of Whitey Bulger is cemented, where, you know, he's up there now with I would say Al Capone and John Gotti. You know what I mean? Yeah. So did the feds protect him one last time and, you know, walk him out the back door? Who knows? Who knows? But it just there's something that really bothered me about that, how he was transferred and why he was transferred and why specifically to that prison. That's kind of a problem prison where a lot of his enemies are, where they knew, like, you know what's going to happen there. You're putting a guy that can't protect himself
right
into a prison with his enemies.
So these are inmates beating him to death, pretty much.
Well, these were mob guys. Yeah. These were mob guys, you know, and you know, who knows, you know. Who knows what really happened, but, wow. I mean, it was just, yeah. Yeah, so that's that ties up the legend of Bulger. So anything else before we move on to Chicago?
No, I'm good.
No, I think we're ready to take the bus and go.
Well, you know, we talked about the cooperation with the Irish, the Jewish gangsters, and the Italians. But there's no, I don't think there's any city where the rivalry between the Irish and the Italians was, you know, more prevalent than in Chicago in the Roaring Twenties. And we talked about Al Capone and really, like, so much of the violence, they can't even put a number on how many people were killed in the '20s. Like, it's unbelievable. And innocent people got killed because this is the age of the Tommy gun and the drive-bys. And, you know, kids got killed in the drive-bys, elderly people, just working people going, you know, walking down the street. And really, not all the violence was attributed to these two guys, but I would say most of it was Al Capone and Bugs Moran. I mean, these two guys hated each other. They absolutely hate each other. And Hollywood always, you know, plays it off that, you know, Al Capone hated the Irish and Bugs Moran hated the Italians. But that's not really true, because Al Capone's wife was Irish, which makes his kids Irish. And a lot of guys in Capone's gang were Irish. And the same thing with Moran. He dealt with Italian gangsters. He had Italian gangsters in his gang. So, you know, I think that the hatred, who knows how it started. There's one rumor that they're just coming out of, they're at a bar and Moran was coming out of the bathroom and Capone bumped into him and they got into a shoving match. Who knows how it started, but however it started, the hatred between those two guys is unbelievable. So let's set up Chicago in the 20s. So Prohibition starts, which really was the dumbest law the government ever put in the place. I don't know what they were thinking. You know what I mean? Like, what were they really thinking? Like, did they think people were going to stop drinking?
Take away the beer, I mean, and the booze.
Just, but, I mean, you know, it just it gave rise to the age of the gangster. I mean, they made so much money on that. But Chicago, we talked about Al Capone. One of the myths is that he was never a member of Cosa Nostra. You know, Lucky Luciano in New York hated Capone. He would not let him in. And there was a Cosa Nostra presence in Illinois at the time. It was outside of Chicago. But the two biggest gangs in Chicago at the time was the North Side Gang and the South Side Gang. Now, the North Side Gang is predominantly Irish, and the South Side Gang is predominantly Italian. But, you know, you did have a little bit of mix in there. The South Side Gang you had was run by a gangster from New York, Johnny Torrio, Italian gangster. And you had Al Capone was his number two. And then you had Frank Nitti, Frank Rio, which were Italian. But you also had the guy by the name of Frank McGurlin, who was Irish, and he was a whack job. I mean, he was crazy. And you had Fred Burke, who was Irish. He'll be one of the triggermen in the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. And then you had a couple of Italians that took Irish names, Machine Gun Jack McGurn and Machine Gun Kelly. They were actually Italian. And then on the North Side, it was run by an Irishman by the name of Dean O'Banion. Now, Dean O'Banion was a classic gangster. I mean, he ran a flower shop there, and he was like a Robin Hood to the people. He would give, you know, soup kitchens. He would have all over town. He would give out turkeys on Thanksgiving and all kind of stuff like that. And his number two was Bugs Moran. And then you also had a Polish-born Jewish gangster by the name of Jaime Weiss, who was extremely smart but very, very violent. And then you had a Sicilian by the name of Schemer Ducci, and he was a high-ranking member of the gang. So, and he was very close to Moran. So anyway, what happens is they set up this. There was other gangs. There was the Jenna brothers were Italian, and I think there was like 10 brothers, and I think Al Capone would take out half of them, and Bugs Moran would take out the other half. I think all the brothers got killed. And then there was like the South Side O'Donnells and the West Side O'Donnells, and there was different gangs, but the biggest was the North Side and the South Side. And there was an alliance between Dean O'Banion and Johnny Torrio. And these guys got along really well. Everybody's making money, and that's what it's all about. It's about making money. And everybody's happy. They're split up their territories. They're distributing the beer to every bar, and if you didn't want to cooperate with them, they were going to strong arm you until you cooperated. And, you know, everybody's making money. So everything was happy, but everybody's happy. But what happened was the hatred between Bugs Moran and Al Capone just got ramped up. And they started to cause problems. They start pissing in the ear of their bosses. And both of them wanted them to start a war with the other side. And neither man wanted to. But what happened was, Moran was able to convince O'Banion that Torrio was making some moves on him. And what happened was O'Banion and Moran go to Torrio and Capone and they say, you know, we're going to sell our brewery to you and we're going to get out. We're going to go totally legitimate. You guys could have the brewery, you know, give us, name your price. This is it. You know, we're out of the business. You guys have it. But the reason they did that is because they found out that it was targeted for a raid. So they sell the brewery, and as soon as Torrio and Capone buy it, the place gets hit by the cops. Torrio gets arrested, Capone gets arrested, and Moran is laughing hysterically about it, you know. So now they don't directly go after O'Banion, because Torrio still kind of wants to play the politics on it. He still wants to try to get the alliance, but Capone keeps pushing him. And finally what happens is Torrio says, okay, go ahead. So Al Capone gets a hitman from New York, a guy by the name of Frankie Yale, and he comes in and he walks in O'Banion's flower shop saying he's going to order some flowers. And when he shakes his hand, he shoots him and kills him right there. And O'Banion's dead. And then this was one of the biggest gangster funerals. Everybody from all over. There was cops there. There was politicians. Everybody. But what happens is Moran is furious. Moran is absolutely furious. So what Moran does is he kidnaps two of Al Capone's bodyguards. And he tortures them. And then he sets them on fire. So now the war's ramped up. So Capone comes back and he goes after Jaime Weiss, and they shoot Jaime Weiss. Jaime Weiss was coming out of a Catholic church, and they shot him on the steps and machine gunned them down. And legend has it that Capone said, you know, don't interrupt the mass, wait till the mass is over, and then gun him down. So I guess it's okay, you shoot him in outside the church, just don't do it while the mass is going on, you know? So Jaime Weiss is dead. So now Capone has taken out Morant's two people that he was closest to, you know, Jaime Weiss and Dean O'Banion. So Morant goes after Johnny Torrio, and him and his crew, they gun Torrio down in the streets, and they shoot him like 12 times. Miraculously, Torrio survives. They blow his kneecaps out, though. He's crippled for life. He's finished, but he does survive the hit because Morant went to shoot him in the head and the gun jammed. But Torrio goes back to New York. He's confined to a wheelchair, and he says to Al, the business is yours. So what happens is Capone kind of gets obsessed with forming an empire, okay, where Morant is obsessed with killing Capone. So Morant never built the empire that O'Banion had. He was just so obsessed with Capone. And the obsession, one of the things he did is Capone had a dog track. And what Morant did is he had his guys kill all the dogs, and they put the heads on the fences outside the track, and then they burned the track down.
Oh, my God.
So, yeah, Morant was Hollywood always portrays it as Capone being the aggressor, but there's no doubt about it, Morant was the aggressor, and he was taking it to Capone, and there was several attempts on Capone's life where he barely escaped, a couple of times at a restaurant where they shot at him. But, again, the collateral damage, you know, people are getting killed on the streets,
yeah.
Innocent people, you know, kids, elderly people, just working people getting killed. And the violence is just ramped up to a whole new level. And the government starts to see this. And this makes Luciano really nervous in New York. Luciano, he's kind of staying in the shadows. He doesn't want none of this nonsense. So he's telling, you know, he's reaching out to Capone, reaching out to Morant. He says, you guys got to end this stuff, end this nonsense. So he did actually have a little peace between them for a little bit, but then that didn't last long. So the war ramps up again, and the violence is just incredible. And it leads to the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, which, you know, Capone has his gunmen dress as cops. They go into a warehouse owned by Morant, and they gun down like seven of Morant's top guys. The problem is they never got Morant. And everybody wonders, how did Morant escape from that? Well, you know, the information I have is that Morant got a phone call, and the phone call came from Luciano. Luciano heard about this. He tipped Morant. Morant escapes. Now, Capone survived that. Or Capone, I mean, he went on to you know, his empire, and Morant went on the run. But, you know, Morant was still trying to kill Capone. So now the government is really like, they're like, enough is enough. And this is where Capone gets set up. And it was Luciano, actually, that set Capone up. And he was trying to do this for a long time. Like, I'm sure you guys heard the story about the baseball bat story with Al Capone, where he beats the two guys with the baseball bat. Well, that's actually a true story. There's two guys, in Selmy and Scalise, that were two of Capone's guys in... Luciano reached out to them to turn on Capone. Capone found out about it, so he throws this party for them, and then he gives them a baseball bat, but takes the bat and he beats them to death with the
Holy
bat.
Shit.
So Capone was violent. There's no doubt about it. He was violent. But Morant was, I think, a different level of violence. So anyway, the war keeps going on, and finally the government gets Capone on tax evasion. And how they do it, really, is Luciano reached out to a couple guys. And there's only really a couple guys in Capone's gang that could have betrayed him. And that would have been Jake Guzik, who was a Jewish gangster who handled all his finances. Irish gangster by the name of Murray Humphreys, who we're going to talk about in a little bit. And Tony Accardo, who we're going to talk about. Who I guarantee nobody heard the name Tony Accardo, but Tony Accardo is probably the smartest mob boss in history. And we're going to get to him next. So anyway, Capone goes down. Morant's on the run. And Morant was never the same. He goes across the country. He's doing, you know, he never had a gang again, more than a couple guys with him. His empire was finished. But the one thing he did is he always harassed Capone. He would call the prison, and he would ask him, you know, he would tell him that he's out with some hot rod, and he's asking Capone, you know, who's your date for tonight? And he tell him about, you know, the meal he's having, and they ask Al, well, you know, what are you having there, you know, in prison? So he keep harassing Capone. But Moran was never the same. But he did exact a little bit of a revenge because 6 years after the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, one of the gunmen, Machine Gun Jack McGurn, whose real name was Vincent DeMora, he would be gunned down in a Chicago bowling alley by Moran and what members of the gang that he had left. And then Moran would just die natural causes, I think, I forget, 1957, something like that. But the one thing about Capone is that the myth, I always see, like, in the movies, I see they portray Al Capone as an old man. I mean, that's ridiculous because Al Capone was never an old man. I mean, he died when he died, I think he died of syphilis. He was only in his 40s. I think he was, like, 46.
Yeah.
And the thing is, when he was boss, when he was on the streets, he was only in his 20s. Mm-hmm. So when he actually went to prison on tax evasion, he was only 32, 33, something like that. So he was never an old man. You know, so that's one myth that, you know. But anyway, that's what happens in Chicago. You know, Capone goes to jail. Moran's on the run. And now this is where Luciano says, okay, now we could, Cosa Nostra could take over that town. And this is where the Chicago gangs actually become what will be known as the Outfit. And the one guy who takes over everything is a guy by the name of Tony Accardo. And I guarantee most people don't even know his name, but Tony Accardo ran Chicago for 60 years. He would take over in the 30s, and he would run Chicago until his death in the 90s. I think it was 1992 he died. And he would never spend one night in jail. So if you're asking me who's the smartest mob boss of all time, it's probably Tony Accardo. And what Accardo does is, well, first he brings in, well, this you know, he had the backing of Luciano, so he brings in Al Capone's guys. He brings in Frank Nitti. He brings in Frankie Rio. And they make them made guys into Cosa Nostra. And then Nitti ends up dead. They said it was a suicide. Who knows? And then Accardo also brings in what's left of the Irish gangs. And that's where a guy by the name of Murray Humphreys comes in. And Murray Humphreys is one of the most powerful guys that I guarantee nobody heard about him either. But the movie The Godfather, the Robert Duvall character is actually based on Murray Humphreys because, you know, the Robert Duvall's character, Tom Hagen, the Irish kid that Don Vito Corleone adopts and then he makes him his consigliere. Well, Tony Accardo made Murray Humphreys his consigliere, even though he was Irish. And then he makes another guy, a Jewish gangster by the name of Gus Alex, as another one, like his second consigliere. And the consigliere, I don't know if you guys are familiar, but that's like the advisor. Like if you're lining up a mob family, you have the boss, the underboss, number two, and then the consigliere would be number three. He would be the guy that advises the boss and handles any disputes between the family.
Right.
And then you have the capos, depending on the size of the capos, you could have like 5 to 20 capos, and then you have the soldiers and associates underneath that. So this is what Accardo did. Accardo brought everybody into the fold. He brought the Jewish gangsters in, the Irish gangsters in, and what he does is when he makes Chicago a powerhouse, when New York has the problems in Vegas with Bugsy Siegel, Chicago goes into that void, and Chicago takes over Vegas. And you know, the brilliance of what they did is they would never, the bosses, Accardo, the money would never, he would never have to go to Vegas. He would send his guys to Kansas City. The Kansas City mob would get the skim from Vegas, divvy it up in Kansas City, and bring it to Chicago. So, I mean, he was staying in the shadows. He was never indicted. He would later use front bosses, and one of the infamous ones we talked a lot on these podcasts was Sam Giancana. A lot of people thought he was the boss. He was only a front boss, you know, and Accardo did that brilliantly. He always had guys. He had Paul Rico was his number two. So he was so well insulated. And this whole time, you know, he would portray himself as a beer salesman, you know, working at a local company there in Chicago. And the whole time he ran Chicago for 50, 60 years in you know, like I said, I think he's the smartest mob boss of all time. So that's pretty much Chicago. That's how it went from the gangs with Moran and Capone, you know, to what was known as the Outfit. And you see the Outfit in the movie Casino. I don't know if you guys seen the movie Casino.
Oh, yeah. That's a great friggin' movie.
See, I'm a little, I mean, I think it's okay, but I didn't love that movie as much as a lot of people
well,
did.
Well, and you know, I could understand that because you probably would emphasize that, I think maybe Hollywood did, you know, kind of fabricate a little, you know?
Well, they did, but the problem I have is like the drama in that movie with like Robert De Niro and Sharon Stone.
Right,
it was
right.
Like, too,
like a love story
too much.
Going
like,
wrong.
Oh, you know? If I want to see that, I watch Hallmark or Lifetime. You know what I mean? Like I don't want to see that when I'm watching a gangster movie.
Yeah,
and that kind of
that's a good comparison. I like that.
Yeah, but I mean, overall, you know, I did kind of show like the ending scene when they're playing the House of the Rising Sun and they're whacking everybody. I mean, that showed you the violence of Chicago. But I think other than that, they really didn't show you how powerful the Outfit was because, you know, is the Outfit as powerful as the commission in New York? I don't know. Probably not because they don't have as many guys, but they did run everything west of the Mississippi.
Yeah.
And they did eventually run Vegas. And like I said, as the mob bosses in New York, they all go down. And, you know, like even Carlo Gambino, I think Carlo Gambino is one of the smartest mob bosses of all time, but he makes a major mistake when he makes his brother-in-law, Paul Castellano, the boss. And that leads to Gotti and eventually the downfall, really, the mafia structure.
Well, I think what, because you know what, it's funny you mentioned about Gambino and Costello because, or was it, yeah, Costello, right?
Castellano. Castellano's the guy, he takes over and then Gotti kills him. We're going to talk about him in probably the next episode.
Yeah, because, I mean, all these names that you're emphasizing right now in this episode, they're highlighted, I mean, significantly in that Fear City.
Was that Fear City? Is that only New York,
just on New York?
Just New York?
Okay. Yeah, the families of New York.
Because I was interested to see if they mentioned Tony Accardo. Because
you know what? I don't remember that name being dropped, but you know,
nobody remembers it. You know, and that's the way he wanted it. That's the way he wanted it.
But here I am. I'm sitting because we're mentioning pop culture movies like Casino and stuff. You know, is Tony Accardo the modern? Like, was that the influence of The Godfather? Like, who? What was The Godfather based on? Was it Al Capone?
You know what? I'll tell you the interesting thing of The Godfather. A lot of people don't notice The Godfather was completely controlled by Russell Bufalino.
Wow.
And we're going to talk about Bufalino. I don't know if we're going to get to him tonight, but people don't realize how powerful this guy was. They think he's just in Pittston, Pennsylvania, and he was a powerful, and he actually controlled True to Unions. He controlled that film.
Yeah.
And what they did is they did take a lot of real stories. They mixed it in. But the Corleone family doesn't really represent any actual family. What he did is he kind of glorified them when you think about it. Because, you know, you have this, you know, the Al Pacino, the Michael Corleone character. He didn't want to get involved. The family doesn't want to get involved in drugs. And we talked about it. The rule is just don't get caught. The rule is not to do drugs.
Right.
And then Michael's dragged into it. He's a war hero. He's this and that. So, and they kind of did show, you know, they kind of glorified it a little bit. And that was because Bufalino controlled it. And a lot of that, you know, The Godfather's a masterpiece. It's a masterpiece of a film. But if you're looking for accuracy and stuff, you're not going to find a lot. You will find some individual stories that they took from the streets and then kind of, you know, Hollywood took their take on it. But as far as accuracy, that's not really. There's no family that.
So
that
there's nothing based set on stone. It's probably more of just an influence of Nick's story, you know?
Yeah. And as far as Accardo, like, he was in the shadows. Nobody knows his name. So there's never been any, you know, film with Accardo. There's nothing like. Nobody, you know. Like I said, that's the way he wanted
it.
He stayed in the shadows and he ran
it. I'm scratching my head over here. It's a name that I'm not familiar with, you know?
Well, it's this thing like Giancana. Everybody was focused on Giancana, and he was just a street boss. He was running things on the street, but every decision had to be approved by Accardo.
Well,
and he was just a master. I mean, even when the feds would kind of get onto him a little bit, he would say he would spread the word that he retired, and he a lot of the guys would actually think he did retire, and. He would spread that word out. So Accardo was a master. He stayed in the shadows and he ran Chicago and he made them a powerhouse. You know, he got them into Vegas. And I think he saw what happened with Al Capone. He saw that if you stay in the limelight if you're always in the papers, if you're always, you want to be a celebrity gangster, you're not going to last. And that's the thing that another myth about Al Capone is that he was this great boss who ran Chicago for 20 years. He was boss for like 5-6 years.
Yeah,
that's it. By the time Torrio gets gunned down by Moran's guys and he just says he retires and he gives it to Capone, I mean, after that, I mean, it was only like 6 years that Capone was boss. So he had a short reign.
Yeah.
You know, and like I said, he's in jail by 33 and he's dead by 46.
Maybe that's what you're saying, though. Maybe his publicity, maybe his popularity of being in the papers and being involved so much. Because, I mean, I remember the documentary that AMC put out there where Lucky Luciano was giving him the warning, you know, saying, you got to cut it down. You got to cut it down. And then eventually it came down to where they knew he was going to be investigated. They knew they were going to come after him. He had to come clean. And that's one of the
reasons Luciano hated Capone, because Luciano was another one that stayed in the shadows. Right. He said there's no benefit to being in the papers, and that's one thing that, you know, John Gotti didn't learn.
Yeah, no good could come from the writing.
And even Whitey Bulger, you know, the one thing I don't know if I mentioned, but one of the things that took down Whitey Bulger, I don't know if you remember this, but when he won the lottery, do you remember that? Yeah, so when he wins the lottery, and obviously, you know, that had to be rigged.
Sure.
I mean, now it's like, here's, you have this guy who's kind of like the wizard and the Wizard of Oz in the shadows, and all of a sudden he wins the lottery. Now all of a sudden the prosecutor, Fred Wycheck, he's like, enough is enough with this guy. We have to take him down. So he got a little too cute with that. So it goes to show you, you know. And another thing Accardo learned is, you know, the Moran, the hatred that Moran had for Capone, Accardo realized that nothing good comes from the wars and stuff. Like, nobody, if everybody's out killing each other, they're not making money.
No, I hear you on that.
And again, you know, that's I think what made Accardo such a great boss. You know.
Well, I think on that note, Sean, we're gonna take a quick break, and when we come back, we will continue. Sean's got more detail to go through, more story. So sit back, relax. We'll be right back.
All right, everybody. Thanks for sticking around with us through our little break there. And we are back and ready to continue on this episode with Matt and Sean. So, Sean, what do you got in store for us next?
Well, we're going to go to Cleveland now. And a lot of people don't know about the war that went on in Cleveland in the 70s. So Cleveland was kind of like every other city where Cosa Nostra has a presence. You have the Cosa Nostra family, and then you have the Jewish gangsters and the Irish gangsters working within that system. Well, Cleveland was run by a guy by the name of Licavoli, and he was the boss of the Cleveland Cosa Nostra family. And there was an Irish gangster there by the name of Danny Green. And Danny Green, there's no doubt, he was a tough guy, and he's a little bit crazy. And he was absolutely, like, he didn't have a fear gene. This guy, the more you read about him, and you guys mentioned you've seen the movie, To Kill the Irishman, that's pretty accurate. The book is written by a guy by the name of Rick Perello, who, he's a cop in Cleveland now, but his grandfather and his uncles were in the Cleveland mob. And he's familiar with, he knew Danny Green, his family knew Danny Green, so the book is kind of very realistic, and the movie's realistic too. I mean, Hollywood, of course, you know, they do take a little bit of a leeway here and there, but overall, it's pretty realistic. So anyway, Danny Green, he's a longshoreman, you know, union guy, and he's a tough guy, and he gets noticed by an Italian gangster by the name of John Nardi. Now, John Nardi is he's under Licavoli, but he hates Licavoli and hates the leadership because his father was killed, and he blames Licavoli. Whether Licavoli was behind it or not, who knows, but Nardi hates Licavoli, and he wants to take over, and he sees in Danny Green somebody that he could form a partnership with and take over. And one thing I want to say is when you get an Irish gangster and you get an Italian gangster working together, they could really do some damage. Like you see up in Boston, you see Whitey Bulger and Stephen the Rifleman Flemmy. You see in New York, you see Jimmy Coonan in the Westies with Roy DeMeo. You see, we're going to talk about later, Russell Bufalino with Frankie the Irishman Sheeran. You see with Tony Accardo with Murray Humphreys. Like when they're working together, they could do a lot of damage. And Nardi and Green form an alliance. And The other key figure in this whole thing is a Jewish gangster by the name of Shonda Burns. Now, Shonda Burns runs a lot of the loan sharking for the family, and Green started off as a muscle man for Burns. And what happens is Nardi and Green start to go off on their own. They're not listening to Licavoli, and they're doing their own thing. And Shonda Burns tries to step in and tell them, guys, you know, we got to work within the system. But Nardi has no interest in working with Licavoli. So what happens is a war starts to develop, and a lot of tension between them. And Licavoli decides, we're going to make a statement. We're going to take out Danny Green. So he sends a guy by the name of Animal Casilio, who was a hitman for the family. And he goes after Danny Green. And what happens is Green ends up blowing him up in a car bomb. The animal survives, but he's injured really bad, and he's kind of out of the mob scene for at least, you know, a decade. He doesn't come. He's totally finished for a while. So the next thing Licavoli does, he sends another guy by the name of John Conti, another hitman, to Danny Green, and Danny Green beats him to death in his trailer. And him and Nardi transport the body. They send it somewhere. I think they found him in Pittsburgh or something. Then Licavoli has another guy by the name of Jimmy Fratto that was in the garbage haul business with Green, and he was real close with Danny Green. And they were able to turn Fratto to try to kill Green. So he tries to kill him like three times, and Green ends up killing him. So now Danny Green's starting to form like a cult following. And what happens is there's reporters following him around, and he's you know, taking care of the neighborhood. He's another guy who's out there handing turkeys out at Thanksgiving and stuff. And the more the mob comes after him, the more he taunts them. And he's actually on the news, and there's news footage you can see online where he's standing there with no shirt on, and he's got his Celtic cross hanging out, and his arms are folded, and he's saying, you know, if these maggots in the mob want to come after me, they know where to find me. So now, Licavoli ramps it up to a new level, and they actually threw a grenade in Danny Green's house. They blew up his house, and he still survived. So there's a great scene in the movie. I don't know if you guys remember, but Paul Sorvino's character, he's supposed to be Fat Tony Salerno from the Genovese family in New York. He comes in, and he's like, you know, because this is an embarrassment to New York. So they step in, and they call Licavoli in, and Licavoli's like, we try to kill this guy. We blew him up, we shot him, the guy just won't die. And Paul Sorvino's like, he's one guy, you guys can't kill one guy. And the thing is, the legend of Danny Green starts growing, and there's actually the songs written about him and stuff, and he becomes a legend in Cleveland. And like I said, he's all over the news, he's taunting the mafia, and this is an embarrassment to New York. So the Genovese family steps in, and they say, you know, something has to be done. We have to stop this. And Licavoli's like, I could take care of this. I could handle this on my own. And what happens is Licavoli's underboss is a guy by the name of Louis Lips Mercelli. And Green and Nardi take out Mercelli, and they shoot him, and they leave him in the back of a trunk of a car. So now they've taken out the underboss of the family. So now it's like, this is unbelievable. And then that's where the car bombs start. And every day there was something like 38 car bombs that went off in Cleveland for like a 6-month period or something. It was just unbelievable, like back and forth. And the movie doesn't show you what the book tells you about how guys had a hit list. Like guys from the Green Nardi side would have a hit list, and they would be driving around in a car for days looking for these other guys. And Licavoli's guys would be doing the same thing, and they're driving around the city, and they got bombs, and this is like out of control. It's like, it's unbelievable. So then finally, after the underboss is killed, Fat Tony Salerno in New York, from the Genovese family, he says, enough is enough. He calls in Licavoli. He says, look, we got to step in and take control of this thing. So what he does is he reaches out to an L.A. gangster by the name of Jimmy the Weasel Fratiano, and he says, I want you to take care of this. Now, New York always looked at Los Angeles as a joke, you know. They always called the Los Angeles Cosa Nostra family the Mickey Mouse Mafia. You know, they never had any respect for them. So I think New York kind of figures, you know, we're going to send one disgrace to fix another disgrace. You know, and when we talk about, I want to talk about Mickey Cohen. We're going to talk about how this Jewish gangster, Mickey Cohen, actually ran L.A., not the Cosa Nostra family. But anyway, so the Weasel Fratiano, he hires a guy by the name of Ray Ferrita to go after Nardi and Green. And at the same time, Chandler Burns, the Jewish gangster, he steps in and he goes to Nardi and Green and says, look, guys, we got to stop this violence. And they tell him, look, you got to pick sides. You're either with us or you're with Licavoli. So what happens is Chandler Burns decides to try to kill Danny Green. So there was ended up, I think there was like 16 or 17 attempts on Danny Green's life, and he survived every one. And what he ends up doing is he ends up blowing up Chandler Burns in a car bomb. And it was, the bomb was, the explosion was unbelievable. They said that they found part of Burns on like a fifth-story building on the roof. Like it was just unbelievable, the bomb. But so Chandler Burns is taken out. The underboss is taken out. So now, you know, it's ramped up to a new level. So anyway, Fratiano goes to this Ray Ferrita, who was a hitman from Pittsburgh. But Ray Ferrita had connections to the Sicilian Mafia. And the Sicilian Mafia is known to use bombs. They use bombs quite a bit. So this is the way they wanted to kill Green, because they had this car bomb war going back and forth. So what Ferrita decides, the first thing he's going to do is he takes out Nardi. So he blows up Nardi in a car bomb. So now Nardi's dead. So now Green goes back and he sets off more bombs. But the way Ferrita was going to take out Danny Green is he said, we're not going to put a bomb in his car. We're going to set another car with explosives, and we're going to park it next to him and then detonate it when he comes out. So what they did is they tapped his phone, and they found out that he was going to the dentist. So they set up this car with explosives, and they parked it next to Danny Green's car. When he goes into the dentist, they park the car there with the bomb. So Danny Green comes out of the dentist. When he goes in his car, Ferrita detonates the explosion, and Green blows up. And here's where, I don't know if this is true, but this is the legend has that there was a reporter found around, and this is where Rick Perello, who wrote the book, he says that Danny Green's last words were, you know, tell those guys it didn't even hurt. And then he used an ethnic slur with it. Now, I don't know if that's true, because, Jen, you would probably know. I mean, if you saw a picture of the car bomb, to me, death would have been instantaneous. You know what I mean? Like, it just would have been instant. I don't know if he really said that. You know what I mean? Because his insides were totally blown out. I mean, he got blown right underneath the car. I mean.
Yeah, I'd have to see the picture to be able to make an educated guess. I don't think so.
I mean, but that, anyway, that's the legend. That's the legend of what he said.
It sounds like a tale.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. But, you know, that this again, a lot of the mob stuff is legend. So it hit the, you know, it goes to the streets, and that's what Danny Green's last words were. You know, it didn't even hurt. But one of the things when Green was taunting the mob, one of the things he would say is that they couldn't kill him because he had St. Patrick on his side. You know, so in he always said that, you know, he was always protected. And one of the weird things that happened is when Ferrita detonates the bomb, him and the guys driving the getaway car, they're going out of the parking lot of the dentist, and they almost run into this lady that's coming into the parking lot, and she gets a really good look at Ray Ferrita. And of all things that this lady could be, she turns out to be a sketch artist. So she goes to, and there's this Polish cop who in the movie Val Kilmer played, the Kovacs was his name, and he had a lot of respect for Green. He knew he was a gangster. He ends up taking care of Danny Green's son afterwards, making sure that he's got out of the life. But he takes the lady in and he says, did you get a good look at him? And he says, yeah, I seen the guy's face. He says, let me get you with a sketch artist. She says, you don't have to. I am a sketch artist. I'll draw you a picture. So she draws a picture, and Kovacs looks at it. He takes one look at it. He says, that's Ray Ferrita. So they bring in Ferrita. Ferrita quickly turns informant, and he rats everybody out. He rats out Jimmy the Weasel Fratiano. They bring him in, and he turns rat. Now, why in the world would they give the guy the nickname the Weasel? You know what I mean? Like, you didn't think he was going to turn into a rat, but he ends up ratting. And it leads back to Licavoli. Licavoli goes down. his underboss, a guy by the name of Leonardo, goes down. He turns a foreman. He testifies against Fat Tony Salerno in New York. They bring that into the commission trial. Fat Tony goes down. So, you know, legend has it that, you know, Danny Green's smiling. You know, St. Patrick was looking at him one last time where, you know, the of all things, that lady was a sketch artist. And she saw who it was that killed him. And then it brought everybody down. And it led to the, you know, decimation of the Cleveland Coles and Oster family. And it led all the way back to New York. It led into indictments into Pittsburgh, into Youngstown, Ohio, to Los Angeles. So that's the story on Danny Green. I mean, he was a crazy gangster. And the thing is, like, when him and Nardi form a partnership, they really do some damage. You see all the guys they took out, the attempts that they had on their life, they couldn't get Danny Green, and they ended up taking out the underboss. They killed a bunch of hitmen that came after them. I mean, you know, it was a force, and it's amazing that you don't hear too much about Cleveland. Even that movie wasn't really publicized that much. I don't even think it was released in the theaters. Wasn't it released? Do you guys remember if that was in
the
theater?
No, I don't think that was a theatrical release.
Yeah.
Do we maybe think it's a streaming movie? Maybe a streaming platform?
I forget. Well, I don't know. Was streaming? When was that movie made? Was that before streaming?
Maybe.
I forget when that was made, to be honest with you.
We'll have to look that one up.
But that is a great movie. I mean, Ray Stevenson plays Danny Green. He plays it well. D'Onofrio plays John Nardi. He plays great. Christopher Walken plays Shonda Burns. I mean, there's a lot of Paul Sorvino plays Fat Tony. I mean, Vinnie Jones is in that movie. There's a lot of good actors in that movie. So that's definitely a classic.
Kill the Irishman, right? That's the
event. Kill the Irishman.
That's
yep.
The one I never
and
saw.
And the movie, like I said, the movie's pretty realistic, and the book is really good. I mean, the book is even better than the movie.
Yeah, that's definitely way before streaming.
So that might have just, would that still be video? Went straight to video? Or was that?
It was 2011. Let me see.
Oh, was it that late? I didn't think it was even. Okay.
I feel like Netflix would have just came out around that time, wouldn't have?
But remember, Netflix didn't start doing, like, shows and movies until, like, the past, like, few years. Because if you remember when Netflix started, it was a DVD-only service.
Well, that's true, too. Yep, you're absolutely 100% correct on that. No, we'll have to look into that, though, Sean. That's good pop culture trivia right there for us to mind and grind.
Let me see.
Oh, and you know what? One thing I want to give you a little pop culture tribute that I forgot to mention when I was talking about Tony Cardo. Tony Cardo is related to like 7 or 8 NFL football players. And the Bosa brothers that played for Ohio State.
Yeah.
You know, I'm talking about Joey Bosa. And I think the other brother, Nick Bosa. Joey Bosa plays for San Diego Chargers. Well, those brothers are Tony Cardo's great-grandchildren.
Get out.
Yeah.
No kidding.
So there's a little trivia there for you.
Wow.
Yeah, it was. It says release date in theaters March 11th, 2011. So it looks like it was.
Okay.
But internationally, it was a straight to DVD release.
Hmm.
A month later.
But I don't seem like, it doesn't seem like that movie gets the credit, though. Like, when people talk about that, like, it's actually like more of a cult following, I think. With
yeah, because I don't even remember hearing about it.
No, I didn't. It didn't get a lot of publicity.
I mean, that's kind of shocking because usually I'm kind of up to date on the mafia movies,
especially
you know.
With the actors in that movie. I mean, there's a lot of big actors in that movie.
Yeah, there's
we'll
a
have to
lot
check
of
that one out.
There.
Yeah, so that pretty much finishes Cleveland. We could start Russell Bufalino. That would be my next topic.
Yeah, definitely.
So everybody knows the name Bufalino, especially this area. And a lot of people don't know how powerful he was within the mob, you know, within the syndicate nationwide. I mean, he wasn't just this guy who ran a local family in Pittston, Pennsylvania. I mean, he was a powerhouse. He had the ear of the commission. And actually, when the Genovese family went through some of their problems, and they didn't have a boss. Russell Bufalino was actually the acting boss of the Genovese family, which is one of the 5 families that runs the commission. So that's how powerful this guy was. And the thing is, he was like a guy that everybody would call in when they had a problem, any family disputes, whatever. Everybody had respect for him. And the close, the two closest guys to Buffalino was Frankie the Irishman Sheeran and Jimmy Hoffa. And the thing is, you know, obviously the outfit in Chicago dealt with Hoffa, New York dealt with Hoffa, Detroit dealt with Hoffa, you know, Vegas. But everything had to go through Buffalino. Hoffa was Buffalino's guy. And if anybody wanted anything done, they would have to go through him. And the thing is, you guys saw the movie The Irishman, yep. Right? So one thing, we're going to be got to be real careful when we talk about Buffalino, because we know he's from this area and stuff. So there's some stories I'm not going to tell you. But the one thing is, somebody that I know that knew Buffalino really well told me that Joe Pesci in that movie was scary good. I mean, he had Buffalino down. He had the mannerisms down. And the thing is, if you look at the other characters that Pesci plays, like in Casino, he played Tony the Ad Spilatro. Goodfellas, he played Tommy DeSimone. I mean, those guys were like cowboys, like wild, loose cannons, you know? And when he plays Buffalino, he's so laid back and he's so methodical in everything he does. So it just shows you what a great actor Pesci is. But anyway, so Buffalino, Sheeran, and Hoffa, they have a friendship. And you saw that in the movie where Buffalino and Sheeran, they were inseparable. You've seen them everywhere. Like the scene where their wives, they're going on a trip together. I mean, they were always together, those two guys. And the thing is, a lot of people don't, here's a myth about Jimmy Hoffa. A lot of people, for whatever reason, think Jimmy Hoffa was Italian. Jimmy Hoffa was actually German-Irish. He wasn't Italian. And he didn't trust a lot of Italians, actually. But Buffalino was the one Italian gangster that he did trust. That was his godfather. That was the guy that he trusted. And the other guy was Sheeran, was the guy he trusted the most. So when people talk about, you know, the movie The Irishman, they're saying that a lot of it's made up and this and that. And now there was stuff that, you know, the stuff on the Kennedys, I already discussed that in previous podcasts. That's all nonsense. There is stuff that he embellished. But the premise of the movie where Sheeran kills Hoffa on Buffalino's orders, I think that part is indisputable. Like, you can't give me another scenario where you put Jimmy Hoffa in that car without Frankie Sheeran, because what happened was Hoffa had a falling out with the mob. So Hoffa goes to jail, and when he's in jail, he gets into a fight with, and they showed us in the movie, but Hollywood takes some liberty there with a gangster by the name of Tony Pro Provenzano, who was a capo in the Genovese family. And Hoffa beat the hell out of him in prison, because Hoffa was a tough guy. He was a fighter, and he was a boxer when he was younger. And in the movie, it looks the other way, like Provenzano beat him up, but that's not what really happened. So now Provenzano wants to kill Hoffa.
Now you're talking about Tommy Pro, right?
Or Tony Pro, yeah. He's the guy that, in the movie, Hoffa says, you know, he wears shorts to a business meeting.
Right, okay, yep.
That's the guy, yeah, Tony Pro. So Tony Pro wants to kill him. When Hoffa goes to jail, one of Hoffa's guys, Frank Fitzsimmons, another Irishman, he takes over the Teamsters. Now, the mob is happy with Fitzsimmons because Hoffa could say no to the mob, where Fitzsimmons won't say no. He's given them, they're happy with Fitzsimmons, and Hoffa wants back in. So Nixon pardons Hoffa. He gets out of jail. He wants back in the union. Fitzsimmons don't want to let him in. So Hoffa tries to kill him. So now Provenzano wants him dead. Fitzsimmons wants him dead. But Buffalino's protecting him. Buffalino's protecting him. And I have a theory on what happened. This goes on for like years. Like, they want to kill him. And Hoffa, you know, every time the commission, this shows you the power of Buffalino. Every time the commission would say, and even Chicago wanted Hoffa out at this point, Buffalino would say, look, no, I'll talk to Jimmy. We'll get Frankie to talk to him. Things will be okay. And they didn't hit him. So that shows you the power of Buffalino, that the commission and the outfit in Chicago would listen to Buffalino. But what happened was, in the 70s, we talked about previous podcast, the Church Committee, where the assassination plots against Fidel Castro came out. And the CIA guys are brought in. And David Atlee Phillips is questioned. James Angleton is questioned. E. Howard Hunt is questioned. These guys, they lie their head off at the meeting. So now it's out there that the CIA went to the mob to kill Fidel Castro. And everybody knows the names that were in on that plot. Giancana, Roselli, Traficante. But the one name that they don't know is Russell Buffalino. Buffalino was in that plot because Robert Mayhew, we talked about a lot on this show, he wasn't happy with the plots, the way it was going with Roselli. So he went to Jimmy Hoffa and he went to Russell Bufalino. And Bufalino had interest in Cuba, so he had an interest in getting rid of Fidel Castro too. So what happens is the Time Life magazine article comes out at the same time that Jimmy Hoffa is indicted, or not indicted, but he's called to testify before the House Select Committee. And the Time Life magazine article mentions the Castro assassination plots, but the one name that comes up that wasn't ever mentioned before was Russell Bufalino. So now, this is my theory. When that comes out, Bufalino's like, whoa, you know, I don't want any part of this. So all of a sudden, the protection that Jimmy Hoffa had from Bufalino, it goes away. So Bufalino okays the hit. And remember when we talk about Time Life, I mentioned this before, who owned Time Life? It was Henry Luce and Claire Booth Luce and their connections to the CIA and David Atlee Phillips. Remember, Claire Booth Luce was in a tight with David Atlee Phillips, one of his assets, and Henry Luce was the guy that was sitting next to that Russian Orthodox priest at that dinner where he stands up and he says, when they were bitching about Kennedy, he stands up and he says, the old man, meaning Alan Dulles, will take care of it. That was Henry Luce. So my theory is Henry Luce owns Time Life. CIA wants to make sure that Hoffa don't talk. They release that information in the article. Bufalino sees it. His name's finally in the limelight. He doesn't want a part of that. He okays the hit. And so Hoffa's called to a meeting at Max's Red Fox restaurant in Detroit. And the thing is, the witness has seen him get into a car. Now, Jimmy Hoffa's not stupid. He was a cagey, cagey guy. He would not get in that car, especially anybody connected to Tony Pro Provenzano. He knows they want to kill him. The only way he gets in that car is if Frankie the Irishman Sheeran is there, because that's the one guy he trusts. And the story that Sheeran tells is that he tells Hoffa, come on, get in the car. We're going to do the meeting at this house in Detroit, because Russell Bufalino's flying in, and he's going to be there, sit by your side, and straighten everything out and get you back into the union. And now, all of a sudden, Hoffa, the two guys he trusts the most, Sheeran and Bufalino, now he gets into that car. So if you think Frankie Sheeran's lying, then tell me how Jimmy Hoffa got in that car. Because if he's not in that car, there's no way Jimmy gets in that car. You know what I'm saying? So Hoffa gets in the car, they drive to Detroit, or drive to that house in Detroit, and then when they walk in, according to Sheeran, he pulls his gun. Hoffa's still not nervous because he thinks Sheeran's there to protect him. Hoffa turns around, he said, let's get out of here, it's a trap. Turns around, Sheeran shoots him in the back of the head, and then, according to him, two cleaners come in, the Andretta brothers, and they get rid of the body, they take it to an embalmer, a funeral home, and, you know, Jimmy Hoffa's dust. They'll never find the body. Right. And that's the story, you know. Now, there's a lot of things in that movie that I think Sheeran, you know, embellished and he lied about, but I don't think the one thing I think he's telling the truth about is, you know, that he's the one that killed Jimmy Hoffa, because either he did it or he knows who did it because he was there, because there's no way Jimmy gets in that car and goes to that house without protection from Sheeran and Bufalino. You know what I'm saying? So, Jimmy Hoffa's too smart.
So you do believe the theory that the Irishman took him out?
I do. Even if he didn't pull the trigger himself, he brought him to that house and maybe somebody else shot him there. But he definitely was involved. And it had to be ordered by Bufalino because, like I said, he was protecting Hoffa for all those years. The commission wanted him dead. The Genovese family, especially Tony Pro, wanted him dead. The Alfred in Chicago wanted him dead. Fitzsimmons wanted him dead.
You're talking people like the commission, too. And you're probably talking Tony Salerno and
the other
head honchos.
Salerno wanted him dead. Salerno and, you know, the Lucchese family, all of them. And the Alfred in Chicago. And another interesting thing, Tony Accardo, too, was mentioned in the Time Life article. Mm-hmm. And when Accardo's mentioned, Sam Giancana gets killed. And that's interesting, too, because Accardo's standing there in the shadows. Giancana's his front boss. All of a sudden, he's mentioned. Giancana gets taken out. Hoffa gets taken out. You know what I mean? And there you got David Atlee Phillips. You got all these other guys. Angleton, they're hiding in the shadows, you know, lying their head off at the committee. And then they go back into the shadows.
Right.
So that's my theory on what happened. But I do believe that Sheeran did take him out. Now, the other big hit Sheeran supposedly did was Joey Gallo. Crazy Joey Gallo. That one I don't know about because I've seen evidence that he might have been involved, and then I've seen evidence that other people might have been involved, so I really don't know what to make of that one. I don't know if Sheeran really did take out Joey Gallo, but I'm pretty confident he's the guy that took out Jimmy Hoffa.
Interesting. And like I said, I just got done watching The Irishman, and the movie was fantastic, like you said.
Oh, it's tremendous. It's tremendous. I do think, though, as great an actor as Al Pacino is, I think there's a little bit more of Al Pacino in that character than Jimmy Hoffa. You know what I mean?
Like,
I
yeah.
think there's a lot of Al in yeah. that. But he's still great. I mean, it's still great. But the way Pesci plays Buffalino is just tremendous. And De Niro did a great job playing Sheeran, too. And the other actors, and Fat Tony's in that movie, too. I forget the guy's name that plays him, but he's a really good actor, too.
Yeah, and like I said, just to piggyback on that, because like recently, I mean, you know, looking this stuff up, that's what I came across. I mean, Frank Sheeran came out and said that he was the one that shot him, you know?
Yeah, and the thing is, like I said, if somebody else has a scenario, give me a scenario where Jimmy Hoffa gets in that car, because he is too smart to get in that car. He knows they're trying to kill him. The only way is if Sheeran tells him, hey, me and Buffalino are going to take care of you. You know, we're going to watch your back.
Yep.
Okay, then the two guys Hoffa, the only two guys that Hoffa trusts, even Jimmy Hoffa's son said the only guy that he trusted enough to get in that car with was Frank Sheeran.
Right.
So,
yep. And
I think that's what
I mean,
happened.
That's interesting because, like I said, you know, if somebody doesn't believe it and they don't buy that theory, then you're sticking to the other 100 stories that people have proposed, you know?
Sure, and most of them have been debunked.
Well, of course, I bet.
You know?
I bet.
Mean, more people admitted to killing Hoffa and admitted to killing JFK. You know what
right.
I mean? Like, it's just nonsense, you know? But, I mean, like I said, give me another scenario that puts Jimmy in that car, because I don't see one.
All right. Well, I...
So that'll wrap that
up. Yeah, I think that's going to end our second part here of Mob Activity. And, yeah, I mean, this is all good stuff. Sean, we're definitely going to have you back on for an episode. Jenna, do you have anything to conclude on? Do you want to wrap it up and... take us to the end?
I sure can. So yeah, we're going to bring Sean back for a part 3, and that'll be out sometime later this summer, because we've got some other good things cooking up in the works for you guys, so you'll have to stay tuned to figure out what those things are going to be. As stated before, if we want to, you know, start making our lists, joining the conversation for next week's episode, we're going to start with back to some regular scheduled programming, and we're going to go with our favorite TV intros and film scores.
Nice.
So we're going to have a nice discussion about some musical aspects of our favorite TV shows and films.
Yep, looking forward to the future episodes here, so.
Yeah, so then, you know, if everybody wants to get their list ready, you can send us an email at garlicjarmedia@gmail.com. If you want to get in on the conversation with us, we'll give you a nice shout out on the podcast. Be like, so-and-so likes this. But yeah, so stick with us, and then we have a rather large giveaway coming up, so we'll have the finalized details for you on the next episode, guys. Alright, so that about wraps us up for the night, and we'll talk to everybody again next week. With a high and a piccolo and a cane.